listeners to another edition of The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. This is Dr. Z, Dr. Eugene Zamperone. I'm a naturopathic physician and an herbalist, and your host for this week's very interesting program, where we have an interview lined up with Dr. Kurt Schnaubert, and he is a PhD in chemistry from the Technical University of Munich. And he's the author of numerous books on the topic of aromatherapy. And we're going to be talking about using the healing intelligence of essential oils, which is actually the name of his latest book, which looks at the biological foundations and mechanisms of aromatherapy. Now, in 1983, Kurt founded the Pacific Institute of Aromatherapy, the first American research institution fully dedicated to aromatherapy. And he's an international lecturer and has presented in diverse forums and scientific events and looked at basically developing and becoming deeply involved with essential oil producers in France and here in America. And people can actually go to school and graduate from the Pacific Institute of Aromatherapy, as it's one of the top aromatherapy institutions of the U.S. if they want to study this field and learn how to apply these very interesting things from plants. Are you there, Kurt?
Having me on. Good morning.
Good morning. Great to hear from you. Well, let's start talking a little bit about defining. Why do they call these oils and resinous compounds essential oils?
Well, I think that's to a large degree historical. When in the Middle Ages, when the distillations, I mean, distillation is older than the Middle Ages, but in the distillations in the Middle Ages, when you first evaporate, like you put the plant into water, you boil the water, and then you see evaporation, and then you condense it again, and then you had that little film of fatty fluid on top of the water that was condensing again, there was a step of purification in between. I mean, and so to the middle-age mind, this must have, since it came out of the sometimes murky and muddy waters of the still, and on the other side you get this clear liquid, it must have been the essence. So, I mean, there was different approaches to that, and I think with Plato it was quintessence, I mean, like the five times purified, etc., etc. So that's where historically the term essential oil comes from. I mean, it has hence, of course, changed meaning. I mean, today there is a more industrial definition for what an essential oil is. I mean, the essential oil is the lipid and the volatile product that you get through this very same distillation process from a plant. Lipid means it's oil soluble, it's fatty, even though it's not as thick as an olive oil or as a sesame oil. It's much more mobile. But it's so unsoluble in water that in this process that I just described, when you distill the plant with the water and then you condense the steam again, the essential oil will actually float on top of the water. It doesn't mix with it, so it separates out. And this is what today is considered to be the essential oil.
And I think it goes back to, as I remember history, Avicenna or Ibn Said was one of the first that was credited with the development of essential oils.
I believe that is, of course, so. I think he was using them. I mean, the process probably is even older, goes to, 2,000 and 3,000 BC.
Oh, okay. Wow.
Into the Harappa culture. And apparently the Chinese knew a little bit about it, too, or maybe even more. But it was certainly Avicenna who sort of created a record for it and was actually using it in his practice.
Now, these odoriferous principles are, they come from special cells in the actual plants, and either they're glands or hairs or oil ducts or various ducts and tubules that transport the oil, and we'll talk about why plants have these things. But why do you think that these plants have such distinctive odors, and what benefit does that have for the plant, you think?
The benefits that the essential oils provide to the plant are those which today, in when you look at, as the book claims, at the biological basis of it, the essential oils are, in that perspective, also part of the large spectrum of secondary, so-called secondary components of the plant. The secondary components of the plant are those that the plants have developed to defend against enemies, to communicate with other plants. It's basically the communication system of the plant. And so without the, while those secondary, they're called secondary because they're not called, you know, registered with the primary components. The primary components are those that provide energy and reproduction, etc., the day-to-day economy. But regulating the plant's relation to the outside universe is the job of the secondary components. And so the essential oils are part of that larger group of secondary components. And yes, then they have the odors, and so partly what the plants achieve with them is not only just defense and attracting insects, but it's one of the few components with which the plants actually can communicate over a distance. As we all must realize, I mean, plants are stationary, so they can't just get up and walk to the grocer and get something. But they, if they want to communicate to the plant over there, the oil needs to travel, or what one of the ways in which they can communicate that is by exuding substances that can travel through air. And this is what is achieved through these components. And as they travel through air, we can, of course, also breathe them in and get their fragrance, smell their fragrance.
Yeah. So it's a communication thing. That's fascinating.
On many levels.
And, yeah, and I guess essential oils communicate with us, too, when we sense them, because clearly if we see the presence or feel the presence or are able to measure the presence through our olfactory system and our other physiological systems, that means that they're somehow registering with our nervous system and our cells and our physiology, and it's more than just a pretty fragrance. Your book is a incredible source of scientific and other information, which talks a little bit about, or quite a bit about, what actually these things are doing physiologically and scientifically. Let's talk about that a little bit. How are these things physiologically active, and what happens when we smell these things?
When we smell essential oils, there is basically two routes of information and influence that are used, or that are being utilized, where we receive information and input from the essential oil molecules. One route is, of course, the olfactory, because we smell them. But then, in addition to that, there is a very small amount of substance that also travels through the mucous membranes and maybe goes into, not maybe, but does go into the bloodstream to some degree, however minute, and will create physiological changes in the bloodstream. I mean, for instance, the electrical resistivity changes, but there's also other physiological parameters that may change. And so between the olfactory impression, which may, of course, register with other memories that we have and create, among others, emotional responses, those combine with the physiological responses that happen when we have the essential oil from smelling them. I mean, but they go to the mucous membranes, and they also are there physiological, even though it's only very small concentrations. They do have They do create responses that way. So what we get from an essential oil is the combination between the olfactory impact and a physiological impact.
So they actually, what do? They bind to actual receptors in our nose, and then that somehow, how does it interact with the nerves and connect to the brain, and then our changes our thinking and emotions, which is, you know, certainly one effect, but then, of course, you know, they interact with many microorganisms and things like that. We'll talk a little bit about it after this question. You know, maybe some of the uses of these things. But go more into the physiology, because I find it fascinating that that your olfactory system is, of course, connected right to the brain. It's like a direct route.
Well, that has been one of the favorite issues for research, And it has been established that, of course, the olfactory system reaches, as you say, right into the brain. So the effects, the olfactory effects, when we register the smell, apparently is divided by the thalamus into three different routes. One goes to the frontal cortex, one goes to the hypothalamus, and then the other part goes back to the limbic system. Mm. So we have three different, we have a thinking, we have a emotional response, and we have the response that to the nervous and immune system that is mediated by the hypothalamus. So the effects, the direct effects that mostly when we feel an essential oil and we feel a physiological change, that is generally mediated from the hypothalamus on down through the rest of the endocrine and nervous system.
Like, for instance, lavender, I know, has a reputation for being a relaxant. And rosemary has a reputation for being kind of more stimulating to the brain. And then also, you know, it's funny because in one of my classes, I teach at the University of Bridgeport at the College of Naturopathic Medicine, and I tell my students when they're studying important things to have a handkerchief dipped in their favorite essential oil and breathe this in as they study. And then, although they can't write crib notes on the handkerchief, bring that into the exam, and that may open up certain neural pathways so they can retrieve the information. This is what I tell them, but now I know that there's scientific proof that that's really could happen.
There is certainly, this is certainly one way in which you can reaffirm memories. I mean, that because, of course, when you memorize, when we feel things, when we look back things, the brain and doesn't just look at isolated data. I mean, it remembers, and also the immune system remembers everything that was, if it was sunshine or raining, and what it was smelling like, and whether you were sitting or standing. So yes, absolutely. If you have a fragrance, you can use that to reassure and reconfirm things that you want to memorize.
Yeah, very interesting. Well, tell us a little bit about the other effects of essential oils, and certainly also many of the plants that we get essential oils from. I know, of course, you know, some people have the very common experience of making a cup of peppermint tea. Well, they're doing aromatherapy in that simple act. And by the way, the fact, I guess, that some of those molecules do get trapped in water means that I guess they can create, you know, some, they can interact with hydrogen in the water and the oxygen. So I would say that some of the oils become semi-miscible in water, but you said the majority of them float on top of the water?
That's correct. And they will always do that when an initial solubility is reached. I mean, like, there's always a very, very small percentage of essential oil that, in fact, will dissolve in the water, let's say 0.1%, mm-hmm. or maybe 0.5%, or maybe in some cases of some essential oils, 1%. And once the water is then saturated to that very low degree, then the oil begins to separate out on top of the water.
Now, it's so interesting. It's interesting that the total essential oil content of plants is generally very low, but when you concentrate these things it, as used in by aromatherapists, they become very powerful medications. I mean, this is something generally you don't see in physiological doses, i.e. making a tincture of a plant or something to that effect, where you're kind of removing all the alkaloids and glycosides and tannins and other pharmacologic agents. You're actually concentrating something that usually the plant keeps in low concentrations. So in essence, the way I teach, you know, somewhat medicinal chemistry at the program, you're actually making it into something that has very powerful pharmaceutical action. What are some of the actions of some of these essential oils, Dr. Kurt?
Well, the first action that was studied and became well recognized is the antibacterial action of essential oils. So when we use essential oils in that way in aromatherapy, we're basically reproducing the same quality that plants have the essential oils for. I mean, plants have other means, too, to defend against pathological bacteria, but essential oils are one of those. And so that has become very well-researched. Now, in my mind, maybe equally or even more important is the fact that essential oils also have very powerful antiviral qualities, which I think is really important because, I mean, if you go to the drugstore today, I mean, you have a litany, you have a whole spectrum of different types of antibiotics, some more effective, some less, but there isn't that much that many antiviral drugs. And until not so long ago, there wasn't really any that were commercially broadly available. So one of the great things of essential oils is that they really help in the home pharmacy. They help protect the layperson against a lot of different viral conditions, and they treat them.
Well, you know, that's interesting you bring that up, home pharmacy. Why aren't these things embraced by modern medicine? What's the politics behind it? Because these things really have stood the test of time. I mean, and no pun intended, the test of time was actually a joke there. That's one of the big ones that we know, going way back to look at the Merck Index of Chemicals. I remember I was reading that book one day and found out that thyme oil, or thymol, one of the extracts of thyme, is so much more potent than phenol, which used to be the gold standard as far as preserving things, cadavers. I mean, there's phenol is so powerful. It used to be one of the ingredients in one of the proprietary disinfectant sprays, and you could basically clean your whole house with these essential oils. But yet, they're not embraced as, especially in our country, as mainstream therapy. How do I know that? Well, when most people go to the doctors, including I've been, you know, to the MD too myself, don't usually go too often, I don't ever see them give a prescription for doing a essential oil vapor steam or any of the particular applications. So what's your feelings about the politics of it all?
Well, I totally agree with you that it's puzzling, first of all, that it's not utilized. But secondly, I think it's simply an outcome of the economic system that we believe in and or that we have in place. And in that particular economic system, it is very difficult. I mean, there's a whole bunch of consequences to what I will be saying, which are not all negative. First and foremost, there is the fact that essential oils are in the public domain, so to speak. So one cannot patent them. The only thing that you might be able to patent in connection with an essential oil is a new form of treatment, utilizing essential oils for a specific treatment. But you cannot patent the substance itself. So your patent will always be what's called a weak patent. Actually the United States of America is in possession of a patent to use monoterpenes, sesquiterpenes, and diterpenes in the treatment of cancer. So you can try and patent novel uses, but you cannot patent the substance. And so therefore, whenever you expend money in researching a new treatment with essential oils, you cannot protect the returns on that. So the ROI, the return on investment, is foggy for, like, let's say, a big pharmaceutical corporation that wants to go into finding out what an essential oil does. So because there is no return on investment, the big corporate entities don't.
So how come it's developed into such a very interesting and profitable venture in, like, for instance, France? I know you mentioned in your book France seems to be a big area where this research is done. Other areas too of the world, of course, but I noticed that the Europeans seem to hold it up as a more trying to think of the right word, but basically they're more into it than we are.
I think in France, in terms of economic distribution through the society, essential oils are not, as a medicine, essential oils are not necessarily hugely larger than here, but it's culturally much more established. I mean, simply for the origin of essential oils from south of France, I mean, because you have all the perfume plants there, you had the tanneries, I mean, in the 11th century that were using essential oils. I mean, when you have the simple and, I don't know, I don't want to say primitive, but I mean, in the 11th century, making the leather had a stench, so you needed some fragrance to cover up the stench. So, then the oils made their way into the court, etc. So it's culturally much more established in France. And so therefore, especially in the south of France and especially in Provence, there's also people, there's farmers that make it their special focus to make beautiful essential oils. So again, while the economic size of it may also not be that huge, there is... It's like people like to make fabulous wines in the Napa Valley. I mean, they have their boutique wines, and in Provence you find people that make their boutique essential oils with, and they're really proud of the beautiful products they craft.
Yeah, absolutely.
And if I may add, I mean, in of course, when you go to other countries, I mean, especially what we now call the developing nations, where there is not a huge pharmaceutical industry guarding its turf, I mean, there, natural means, of course, also become more important because it promises independence or less of a dependence on expensive imports. So countries in the developing world, they have an interest in finding treatments that can be done with essential oils, because typically those countries have lower wages, and so producing essential oils is more of an economic reality, and if there is bona fide medicinal qualities to them, then of course they're much more inclined to use them than when you have, you know, big pharmaceutical giants guarding the territory.
Yeah, so it's I like the idea that it's come into self-care, and I think that's great that people can use it, and force wisely, they need a book like yours so that they can use these things with respect. Because, like you mentioned, and you caution many times in your book, that these are like medications in a way that they are very concentrated parts of the plant. And, you know, if I could use like an analogy with the... you know, some of the superhero movies that have been out over the last few summers, you know, with great concentration comes great respect, and you must respect
Absolutely.
These essential oils because they are both powerful, they wield great power, but they wield also some cautions that people need to do. So tell us a little bit about, first, before the cautions, how people can use these essential oils. I showed one way early in the discussion where people could put it on a handkerchief and breathe it in to elicit memories and bring that back, open up the neural pathways. But there are many ways that people can use essential oils. Let's elucidate that for the listeners out there.
Well, the two most easily accessible ways to use essential oils in classic ways are, of course, the one where you basically use the essential oil for its fragrance and the various impacts that the fragrance, as we have discussed, will initiate. So you would maybe, especially in the case of mild essential oils, and I mean it would behoove everybody who wants to do that to study a little bit which ones are mild and which ones maybe are not so mild, but let's just say we can't figure out which oils are mild. You would put these oils, a droplet, simply, let's give an example. Let's say you could use neroli, which is orange blossom essential oil. You could put a drop on your wrist and a drop on your temples, and the intended effect is that it is anxiolytic. This will, if somebody suffers from anxiety, this will to some degree ameliorate the anxiety. So this mainly works through the fragrance effect. And then the second really simple and classical way of application of essential oils is topical on the skin. So it's very straightforward. It's not a big science. I mean, everybody can put a little bit of essential oil in a larger bottle of fatty oil such as sesame oil or avocado oil or hazelnut oil or almond oil, whatever the choice is, and put a little bit of essential oil into the carrier oil, as we say, and then use that on the skin as a body oil, I mean, for either relaxation or simply for grooming, and by even using the oils for grooming, you will then get all the health side effects automatically for free.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but some of these oils can be used for many other conditions. For instance, you know, camphor is one of the ketone essential oils that I know has been used since antiquity for myalgia and aches and pains in rheumatism, which is my specialty, is looking at rheumatic illnesses. And then you could use the essential oils of cinnamon also to move the blood and lymph. So it gets more complicated. And in your book, I like you have some really excellent recipes for if somebody has some mild aches and pains, how they can make their own natural version of some of these proprietary rubs that you see on the many of the drugstore shelves. And you know, the benefit of that is, of course, if you get the pure essential oils, Dr. Kurt, you're not getting the negative effects of some of the synthetic oils where they try to make this in a chemistry lab. Talk a little bit about the difference between a high quality essential oil from a natural source, and sometimes you're walking in the mall and you pass one of these perfumery chains and you think you might be buying some essential oil, but you're not. You're buying a lot of garbage, I guess.
Well, our experience is that when you use, I mean, I cannot really back this up with a scientific study, but having been in the field for as long as I have been, our experience is that when you use what we call authentic essential oils are essential oils that really come from the plant that the label claims that the oil is from, and if there's nothing been done to the essential oil. And the essential oil is then used somewhat wisely, meaning, you know, not using irritant essential oils like undiluted on the skin. Let's say we eliminate those unwise uses or those like patently, you know, asking for provocative uses. If we use the oils wisely, then we have not observed allergic reactions or any kind of untoward reactions. There are some essential oils which do create a dermatitis reaction. I mean, that by some percentage of the population, that would be, for instance, clove oil. So we have to be aware of some things. But again, and when we learn, I mean, these oils typically are listed in the first part of every book or when you start to study this, so it's not difficult to exclude those. Let's say we are able to exclude those, and then you use authentic essential oils, we have not observed adverse reactions. It's as simple as that. And I do attribute that to the fact that we have evolved with the essential oils. So for reasons that are not necessarily clear to me, but in the process of evolution, if an essential oil or if essential oil components really would have had disastrous effects on us or on animals, it would may not have been so beneficial for the plant either. So in the process of evolution, as it has worked, there doesn't seem to be a lot of space, at least not in the communicative lipid components of the essential oils, for really adverse qualities. We have not observed it.
Well, you know, I've seen some people get certainly some sensitivity reactions with some of the, you know, stronger aldehydes like
absolutely
citronellol,
I mean,
and things like that. And we do recommend, and then I think we're going to take a break after this comment, but we do recommend, I guess, trying it on a small surface with, like you mentioned, a carrier oil. We'll get more into some recipes when we return after a quick station break. And if you're just joining us, of course, you've been listening to the Natural Nurse and Dr. Z, and we have Dr. Kurt Schnaubelt on, and he is the author. He's a PhD in chemistry, and he's the author of The Healing Intelligence of Essential Oils, The Science of Advanced Aromatherapy. So stay tuned for more information right here on Progressive Radio Network. And we're back with more of The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z, talking about the healing intelligence of essential oils. And where can people get your book, Dr. Kurt?
I would like to think at every major bookstore.
Okay, and it's put out by healingartspress.com out of Vermont. And the back of the book says, Exploring Science's New Biological Understanding of Essential Oils and Their Advantages Over Synthetic Drugs, renowned aromatherapist Kurt Schnaubelt reveals how the effectiveness of essential oil treatment stems from our common biochemical and cellular heritage with plants. He explains how essential oils preserve a plant's complex natural life-supporting and immune-building qualities developed through millions of years of interactions with humans and animals. And then he goes over the molecular, cellular, evolutionary biology. And then he gives you some great recipes about what to do for treatment opportunities, many types of things like healing hepatitis, which I want to talk about definitely before we end the program, osteoporosis, UV damage. That's very interesting. We live in a time where there's so many people that have bad sunburns from the 1950s and 60s, and now they're paying the damage, I guess, and basically how it can even be used for cancer essential oils and builds one's immunity when people around you are falling from the flu. And as we change in our country here, as we change into the more fall time, this is where it does put a strain on our immune system, and we can use essential oils for preventing flus and colds. So what's a good way to do that, Dr. Kurt? Is there any particular ways and methodologies you'd recommend?
I would suggest that everybody who wants to do that really starts out maybe before you get sick, so that we build some familiarity with the essential oils that we're going to mention, so that we don't go out and when it's late and or too late, or we are having a condition that we say, okay, I heard this on the radio and I would like to get this oil, then you're contending with A, your condition, and B, with the fact that you're not really familiar how to use this. So, I mean, if one wants to do that, it's a good idea to create that familiarity ahead of time. Now, one of the oils that one can use to strengthen the immune system when the flu goes around is, for instance, the Niauli essential oil. It's N-I-A-O-U-L-I, Niauli. It's a Myrtaceae. It's a Melaleuca quinquinervia with its botanical name.
So it's a cousin to tea tree, then?
It's a cousin to tea tree, yeah. And tea tree can also be used, but the Niauli, when it comes to prevention, in my appreciation, is a little bit more efficient. It's totally non-toxic. It's also non-irritant. It is a strong essential oil, but that oil can, for instance, be used as in the way that we described ahead, you know, earlier, in a base oil and being put on the body. Once one becomes familiar, one of the ways to use an essential oils, use an essential oil in a quick and quick fashion, and is to simply put some drops while one is taking a shower. Put some essential oil, a drop, four or five drops of the oil, on your hand while you're wet in the shower, and use the wetness on the skin to have slip and distribute the oil all over the body. Mm-hmm. Especially with the Niauli oil, that could be a very efficient way to ward off the flu that's going around with everybody else. I mean, and again, this may sound a little innovative or a little not very familiar to many listeners, so hence the suggestion to try that ahead of time. I mean, to become familiarized with the strength of the essential oils and how one feels with the various applications. So Another essential oil to prevent respiratory conditions as they go around would be Ravintsara, Cinnamomum camphora, which is from the Luraceae. That's another essential oil. It's very mild, very good antiviral power, and it can complement the Neauli that we just spoke of.
Yeah, you mentioned that that was actually very good for shingles outbreaks. And
that's correct.
Interesting.
We consider it the state-of-the-art treatment for shingles is the combination of Ravintsara and a specific fatty oil by the name of Calophyllum, or some people call it Tamanu. So mixing these two essential oils has brought many distressed patients rather surprising relief from the very painful shingle outbreaks. Yes, that's correct.
And on page 143, here's a Dr. Taylor's fall-winter respiratory blend. And, you know, now's the time to start doing that as the weather changes from, you know, September's fickle. This is really where the equinox is, where we can have summer-like weather. We can also have fall-like weather with its harshness and dryness, which definitely affects the lungs. I know in Chinese and Ayurvedic medicine, the fall is the time for the lungs. And so this is where using things like, she mentions, cypress and ginger and eucalyptus and hyssop and thyme and tea tree, all can be used. Now, can you drop these into a pot of recently boiled water and create like your own steam tent? Is that a good way to do it?
That's a wonderful way to do it. I personally sometimes don't gravitate so much to it because sometimes the water is still a little bit hot and then there's a lot of oil coming towards you, and then sometimes as it gets cooled down it's not so. But it's of course a very safe way to use the essential oil and inhale it. If I may add something to that, another
sure.
very simple way to utilize the essential oils for the lungs and to prevent respiratory conditions is to just take a 2-inch by 2-inch piece of paper towel and put a drop of your essential oil or your essential oil mixture on that and roll that into a small little piece of straw. And before you go to bed, you stick it into your nostril and you breathe through the paper. So that way, the essential oil travels into the throat and into the upper respiratory system, and it also becomes absorbed. So it's very inexpensive, but very efficient.
And also you get like 8 hours worth of exposure to these oils, which is going to be more than just, you know, doing it in the shower or when you're
correct.
When you have the availability of making a steam tent, which is only, you know, when people rushing off going to work and things like that, you need some time for these things to work. I think that's a great suggestion. I was actually going to say put it in some type of a cool vaporizer at night so you're breathing in these things, but I like the idea of just putting it right in the old schnoz.
That's one way. And then, of course, if you don't want to sleep with the little paper things in your nostrils, I mean, another way that's really simple is to put a couple of drops on the pillow that you're sleeping on. I mean, and don't make it too strong, but and choose oils that are pleasant for you. I mean, if you don't like the fragrance of this one, then use another one. Or if it's too, if the one maybe bites a little bit too much, use one that's milder. And that's one of the beauties of essential oils is that they all are such complex mixtures that we are so conditioned to think that it has to be, when you have condition A, you have to use exactly essential oil B to get result C. But very often, which is very odd to the conventional pharmacological mind, the essential oils seem wildly interchangeable.
So you could use many different things, even though...
That's correct. The Neauli doesn't work for you because, it when you're new to this, the Neauli may not be the most pleasant smell. Well, then put some lavender and sage on the pillow if that's more pleasant, and breathe in those, and the effects will be very much similar or the same.
And that's because the plants usually don't have one essential oil, but they have blends of different ones. Is that true?
That's absolutely correct. I mean, when we analyze the essential oils and with a regular, as they come today, GC or GCMS setup, it's typically easy to find 100 or 150 different components in a single essential oil. Yes.
And this might be interesting to put forth to the listeners. This might be why many viruses haven't really been able to defend themselves against the oils. You know, when you're using a standard allopathic antiviral drug, it's basically one patented molecule like you discussed earlier. But when you're using a plant, even if it's just one essential oil, it may be a blend of literally hundreds of chemicals. The virus doesn't have a chance to mutate and sayonara.
That's absolutely correct, because there are so many different components in one essential oil. What we observe is that there is not one mechanism by which an essential oil would inactivate a virus, but there is typically always more. Mm-hmm. So maybe an oil blocks the receptor to which the virus has to dock in order to get to the cell, but at the same token, some other components in the essential oil may attack the membrane of the virus, and then there may be other biological processes that are also being initiated. So as a virus, as you just said, can of course develop resistance towards a given mechanism, but it's much harder to develop resistance against seven different mechanisms that happen simultaneously.
Yeah, so that makes a lot of sense. What about using these things internally now? Some people have heard that, and this might be just common folklore, that you shouldn't use these essential oils internally. They're too powerful. They can have toxic effects. This is the word on the street, Dr. Kurt. What's really the truth behind that?
In my experience, the truth behind that is that if you do want to take essential oils internally, you have to do some studying. I mean, you should avoid some of the essential oils that have a high ketone content, or you should avoid also the essential oils that may create strong irritation, which even though is not so much an issue when you take them internally, but especially the ketone essential oils should not be taken internally in any kind of appreciable dose. I mean, only very, very minute doses are okay there. But other than that, it's one of the culture wars in aromatherapy. I mean, so if the oil is authentic and is non-toxic, I mean, let me give an example for an oil that can perfectly be taken internally, and that would be lemon essential oil.
Sure.
If you have a drop of lemon oil, you can put a drop or two in a glass of water and stir it up and drink it, and it will initiate the phase 1, phase 2 liver enzymes, et cetera. So right, there is going to be beneficial effects from that. You start detoxifying.
Right, and some of the ketones would be like thujone, which we do take. You know, we take internally as food in the form of, you know, spices like, you know, sage for our Thanksgiving stuffing, or if you eat that stuff, or you know, other types of things, clary sage, even some wormwood tea, which people do take as a bitter to help with eating the Thanksgiving dinner. But nonetheless, some of these are very powerful and can affect the brain. Doesn't the absinthe liqueur come from some of the thuja plants or artemisia plants,
yes,
which have some known hallucinogenic or psychogenic or entheogenic effect on the brain?
That's correct, yeah. So the quote-unquote psychotropic component there is the thujone from the wormwood in the absinthe. I mean, at least that's what one school of thought is saying. Yes, absolutely.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
With the thujone that you mentioned in sage and the wormwood, that's where you said we use it as a tea, and that's correct, because there we have concentrations that our bodies easily manage. But when you come to the essential oils, that's when what we discussed earlier, that the fact that they're so concentrated there all of a sudden starts to become a fact that has to be reckoned with, that when it comes to thuja essential oil or to wormwood essential oil, the thujone is present in such concentration that it actually can have detrimental effects.
Right, right. I mean, we could use them topically. I noticed in your book, and I know it's an old-time
naturopathic therapy for warts is to put a drop of Thuja or Arbor Vitae oil right on the wart, and it does have antiviral effects against the HPV virus. I've seen that.
It absolutely does, yes. Mm-hmm.
We've actually used it on a woman's cervix as part of the cervical dysplasia, what they call the escharotic treatment that was developed by old-time naturopaths and written about also by Dr. Hudson, who published different studies on that, showing that it can actually cure people of cervical cancer, and we have cured people of cervical cancer as evidenced by normal pap smears afterwards lasting for at least 5 years. Now, there's applications for other types of cancers with essential oils. We only have about 7 more minutes in the program, but let's talk a little bit about some of the more chronic diseases, like you mentioned in the book, hepatitis and then cancer and things like that. So there's some applications that would be more in the realm of serious illnesses versus a cold or flu or repelling mosquitoes.
The conditions I'd like to mention is there is, in terms of chronic conditions, one of the things that I would like your listeners to know is that the Everlast essential oil is a very strong anti-inflammatory essential oil, so it has helped many different individuals with their rheumatoid arthritis pain. I mean, it doesn't necessarily cure it, but it ameliorates it while we use it topically.
What's Everlasting, Kurt?
Everlasting is
not familiar
the
with
essential
that
oil from Helichrysum italicum in the Pacific Northwest. It's indigenous also to the Pacific Northwest. It's called curry plant there.
Oh, interesting. Wow.
It's not an entirely inexpensive essential oil, but it's so effective. It can be used in very high dilution, can be put on the joint, and it just simply eases the pain.
Wow.
Now, in terms of the hepatitis, one of the key essential oils there that apparently, and again, there's a little bit of a lack of research there, but there is some. One of the key essential oils is Greenland moss, Ledum Groenlandicum. I mean, that apparently stabilizes the membrane of the hepatocytes of the liver cells, and the clinical effect of it is that actually the enzyme readings of the SGOT, I mean the liver enzymes, they drop.
Mm.
So
you
can actually reinforce the integrity of the membrane of the liver cells with the Greenland moss and maybe thyme thujanol and maybe some carrot seed essential oil. And as you mentioned, cancer, one of the politically not contested ways to use essential oils is when you use, and which is also described in, of course, in more detail in the book, is to use essential oils to ameliorate the side effects of conventional treatments. Because, I mean, a lot of patients will ultimately decide to undergo conventional treatment and then have sometimes very, as we all know, very strong side effects with chemotherapy or radiation therapy. And there is some very useful protocols to ameliorate, for instance, the nausea and vomiting that goes along with chemotherapy.
Yeah, I noticed that. And also people that have lymphedema, if they've had surgery that's interrupted the lymph flow, there could be some aspects of using it there, maybe even stimulating the healing of the skin if there's a surgical wound. And I like the idea that most of these essential oils definitely help out with infection, because we talked about that many times, that that's one of the main uses of some of these oils. Essential oils are still used in dentistry. They're so effective. Not only do they kill pain like a true anesthetic, eugenol, but it actually is a great antimicrobial as well.
Yeah, but I would like to come back to one of the things you just mentioned. You said wound healing and in connection with surgery. I mean, that's, again, one of the areas where the Everlast essential oil has no rival. Mm. So when the Everlast oil is used, I mean, it can be used before and especially after surgery, the healing of the scars is so much improved with the essential oil, to the point where if the oil is used right after, I mean, after the wound is dry, of course, when in, let's say not immediately, but I mean shortly after surgery, that the scars actually completely heal and they are not visible. It's quite unbelievable.
Yeah, that's what I'd like to try. I have a number of patients with problems with that. We've used, you know, Go-To-Cola and other things to help them, but I'm gonna start using this oil, this Everlasting. Thank you for that wonderful tip. So, in the last few minutes, let's talk a little bit about why the healing intelligence, why it's different from other aromatherapy books.
I think the big difference is that in older books we have, and I'm particularly to blame for this. I don't want to, like, you know, talk to me, accuse other authors. I mean, this is to some degree reflecting my own development. As you mentioned in the introduction, I'm a chemist, and so it was the classic French scientific aromatherapy that was having the rational or having the logical approach that it is the components, once you know the chemical components in the essential oil, then you can determine their pharmacology and from there understand why they do what they do. Now, while this is certainly true, there is another aspect to essential oils, which is that they come from plants and that they are an expression of the whole organism. And there has been a field developing, I don't know since when, but it's rather new. It's called systems biology. And in systems biology, you recognize that as the level of biological organization goes higher and higher, that there is properties evolving, so-called emergent properties, that are not explainable from knowing the detail of the lower. Like, when you know the detail, everything about a cell, you still don't know what the kidney is doing that is formed from so many cells. Or if you know all the details of a cell, or maybe the molecules that are present in a cell, it does not teach you the lung function that all these cells will make up when they form a lung organ. And then also, when you bring all these organs together and you have a complete organism, it does not help you to know all the molecular detail. I mean, if I can be folkloristic here a little bit, all the molecular detail of the cells that are going into building this organism is not going to tell you whether the organism is going to be intelligent or not so intelligent, or territorial, or open-minded. I mean, so none of these things are predictable. So, and this is also true, I mean, of course, for more, let's say, pharmacological or healing qualities, that the book contends that the healing quality that comes from these oils to a large degree is the healing quality that comes from the particular plant organism. And my example here is, again, the Everlast essential oil. The Everlast essential oil, I mean, the ones that we use these days come either from Corsica or they come from the Balkans. And when you use these two varieties, I mean, they may have different chemical composition, and they actually do have different chemical composition depending on their provenance and where they come from. However, they do exactly the same. They both are extremely fabulous wound healers. Yeah. They work, as we discussed, for arthritis-type pains. So we don't distinguish their properties, even though they have different chemical compositions. So what I'm suggesting in the book is that we understand the qualities that the essential oils bring to us also as a quality of the whole plant organism and not just of isolated molecules.
Great. And thank you very much for that wonderful program. And I'm sure we learned a lot about the healing intelligence of essential oils and the science of advanced aromatherapy. And we wish you luck with your book and appreciate your coming on the air today.
Thank you so much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Okay. And that does it for this edition of The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. You can always get more information about our up-and-coming things at Dr. Kamai's website, The Natural Nurse, and her website is naturalnurse.com, www.naturalnurse.com. I'm Dr. Z. Dr. Z Naturally, wishing you the best. Stay healthy, folks. Bye-bye.